I want to begin with what pops into my email from the Society of St. John the Evangelist, and it's free. It's called Brother, Give Us a Word. And so there's one word every day and a little sentence or two about the word. Yesterday, I was in Baltimore doing a retreat on prayer, and the word that popped up yesterday morning was pray. So the word that popped up this morning is patience. And I think when we're dealing with grief, patience is something that we need a great deal of. It says, if we speak too quickly or define too readily what we are witnessing, experiencing, we may actually confine God's revelation.
And I get SSJE every day, too, and I highly recommend it. It has a short blurb, like she said, that you can do quickly if that's all the time you have, and then you can click on something that gives you a much fuller message from one of the monks that are up at this monastery in Boston, and it's well worth reading.
And it's an Episcopal monastery, so you don't get a lot of Catholic kinds of things. Not that Catholics don't have lots of good things to say. Last time I read a little bit from this book, Circle of the Spirit by Joan Walsh Englund. It's a book that got me through some very difficult times. So here's another excerpt from this. Shadow. Doubt is a shadow, like a dark bird wing across our bright belief. Let its shadow pass. Do not follow its flickering darkness to where its deeper shadows nest. Death can seem darker and the darkest shadow, but it is only that, a shadow. Be not afraid. It has no substance and passes as a shadow. Only a shadow, a momentary darkness upon a glistening terrain. Because the sun dips its bright face beneath the horizon, do we doubt that we shall find it again tomorrow, shining brightly? So too, through the spirit, though the spirit dims its light in that which we have named death, shall we not again discover that same bright force waiting for us beyond the passing shadow? Though the eye does not see, the soul knows the way. Trust. Excuse me. Last week, I introduced myself by saying I'm not an expert in this area. I am not a theologian, but I've done some theological training. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't come at this from that perspective. I come at it from my own experience, and primarily I've had many, many experiences of grief in my life and have walked with many people who have gone through grief in lots and lots of different forms. And my own experience primarily is that I lost my first husband when I was 35. I had two young children to raise. He was ill for a long time. We did not know what the illness was, and he passed away at the end of November in 1982. Some years later, I remarried, and I married Bishop Mark Dyer, who was a theologian and a retired bishop from the Diocese of Bethlehem, Episcopal Diocese, and he had been a monk for 15 years. He had done a lot of his own grief work, including his father, who died when he was 16, his son, who was born with profoundly developmental issues. Matthew was born without a brain. He was only supposed to live for 6 months. He lived for 29 years and died in Mark's arms. And the loss of his wife suddenly from an aneurysm. So we had a lot that we shared in those kinds of things. My most profound experience was 3 years ago when Mark died of multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer that there is no cure. There is some treatments, and so they prolonged his life for about 18 months after the diagnosis. So that's where I come at this from. I've done a lot of reading, and you'll see on the resource sheet all of the books that I've read, both before and during and following Mark's death. There's always something new coming out. I find poetry touches me very deeply. That's why this book is meaningful. I find that some people who write about grief are very matter-of-fact and say, oh, well, it's really nothing and people should get over it. And then other people who are very compassionate and understanding and experience that. So that's a little bit about where I come from and what I'm going to share with you today. I notice a lot of new faces. So one of the questions I asked last time is, how many of you have lost someone close to you? How many of you have lost a spouse? A child? A brother or sister? Okay. How many of you have lost someone who is living with you at the time? Okay. All of those experiences are profound. They are unique. And if I can get anything else as part of these times with you, these three Sundays with you, it's that every grief experience is unique. It depends on the relationship you have with the person who died. It depends on the circumstances of their death. People who die after a long, painful illness, we sometimes feel relief for them and for ourselves. But people who die suddenly, those who died just last weekend, those people, those families will grieve for a very long time. That a sudden, unexplained, inexplicable, disastrous event, such as the shootings in Las Vegas, is just something that's very, very difficult for people to get over. It is why those who lose loved ones to random shootings have a very hard time. We feel like, where was God in this? And we often ask that question. But even that experience, what we believe about God, what we ask of God, what we want of God, shapes how we grieve and what we might think about or pray about. One of the things that I've said often, and I don't know, and I can say this here, and I probably need to do some research on it, I don't know how people of no faith or weak faith, not strong foundation, deal with death. Because if it were not for God and God's support of me and my prayer life, and the community that I belong to, both at Virginia Seminary and at St. Paul's in Episcopal Church in Old Town, if it were not for the people surrounding me and my own sense of God's presence in my life, I would find it very difficult to get through the experiences that I've been through. And
I think it's just as difficult in many Christian communities as well, though. My daughter's roommate committed suicide her senior year of college, and my son's girlfriend's sister committed suicide within the next year. And, you know, here I have this wonderful community of Westminster, which is wonderful, and I love it. But it can be just as lonely when you have complicated death, even if you are a part of a Christian community.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't mean to imply that at all.
I'm just, you know, bringing that out. Yeah. I think a lot of us go through all kinds of situations, and we have this wonderful community, and yet we're very private people.
That's true. Absolutely. Thank you. So just to witness that, it has been my faith that has helped me through, and not that there hasn't been very, very lonely and difficult times. So that's a little bit about me and where I come from. Do you have any questions before we begin? Okay. Good. If you have any questions along the way, please stop and interject. It's the way we're going to work. As I do research and read and listen to people talk, one of the things that comes up is the way that our emotions are involved in our grief process. Some of us are very open with those emotions. I cried all over the place. Every place I went, there were tears. Now, people said, oh, but you cry so gracefully. I cried how I cried. There were times when I was not very graceful. But I still occasionally will be somewhere. And I was, as I said, at this prayer retreat yesterday, and someone came up to me and said, I knew your husband. And we shared, and there were a tear or two that creeped out. So crying is a very, very important kind of thing, but everyone does not express their emotions that way. And sometimes, particularly men, think it's not masculine to cry. Research, scientific research into emotions has shown that crying gives a great deal of release to what building up inside of us. We may not think it does, and we may think it makes us look weaker or less able to cope. That's not necessarily true. Crying can be an excellent way to release, if I can say that, to release the feelings that you are having. And certainly to cry with someone else is a wonderful way to share their grief and yours. I may have shared this story last week. I couldn't remember if I did or not. But I heard about a little boy who was in the church community, and there was a man who had lost his wife, and he had kind of been, you know, very withdrawn, very recalcitrant, didn't really want to talk to anybody. I think I need to scoot back a little bit here. Didn't want to talk to anybody, didn't want anybody to talk to him, and nobody could get through to him. People tried to console him, and he just didn't want any part of it. And this little boy went up and sat next to him, and everybody kind of went, oh, dear, what's going to happen now? Is he going to push this kid away? What's he going to do? And the little boy just sat there. And a little while later, the little boy got up and came back, and the man joined in the conversations after that. And they said to the little boy, what did you say to him? And he said, I didn't say anything. I just helped him cry. So don't underestimate children's ability to empathize with others or their ability to feel grief, even though they may go off in the next room and play with their toys as if nothing happened. We all feel loss when it happens. So there were three ways that people talked about in terms of responses to grief. And one was the word I just used, recalcitrant grief. And I used the word last week, complicated grief. So it's different terms depending on who is talking about it. Recalcitrant or complicated grief is grief that goes on for a long period of time. The length of time was 6 months, but my grief lasted for 2 years. And recalcitrant grief means that you have a risk of going into severe depression. I took antidepressants. They seemed to make me feel nothing. I didn't want to smile and laugh. I didn't want to cry. I just didn't feel anything. And that wasn't helpful. My doctor, who was very, very understanding, helped me with different kinds of antidepressants until we located one that allowed me to have some kind of feelings and didn't totally suppress my emotions. And even though I cried all the way through all those depression so it didn't matter much. But it's important that we note when people are moving into a prolonged sense of grief or a deep sense of grief, because they probably need some help. Now, whether it's antidepressants, whether it's counseling, whether it's support groups from hospice or other kinds of groups that help people work through these kinds of experiences. When I my first husband died, of course, as a young widow, there really weren't very many support groups that were available to me. I had a friend who was a social worker and a counselor, and she recommended a couple. Well, I went to one, and it was around Christmas time, and everyone in the room was 65 or older, and I was 35. And they were talking about how they were going to be going on a cruise for the holidays because they wanted to get away, and how their adult children needed to go on with their lives and their Christmas celebrations. And I sat there and said, but this was not for me. Then I went to a divorcees group, which was the other group she recommended, and I sat there and listened to all the women, there weren't any men in the group at that time, complain about how horrible their exes were. And I said, not for me. I don't want to complain about my ex. I'd like him back. Thank you very much. And so I could not find a support group at that time. I did go to counseling, and that helped for a little bit. But finally, what I found that was extremely helpful was a spiritual director, someone who could talk to me about my first husband's death in relation to God and my faith experience and where I was on my faith journey. And that was the most helpful to me. This time around, I went to a social worker, licensed social worker counselor, one who was designated as a grief counselor. She was lovely, very nice person, and I just went there and cried every week and didn't feel like I was getting anywhere. Finally, again, after a year, I refound another spiritual director because that had been helpful the first time around. And that, again, became my way back through. And as a result of that, I think I also told you last week, I am in a program to become a spiritual director. So that profound experience has affected me. And that's one of the things we want to talk about a little bit is how might you use a sense of grief or a way of working through your own grief or helping someone else work through their grief by finding something that is a meaningful pursuit for them, a meaningful future. So recalcitrant grief, watch out for that. Whoops. The other kind of grief is recovery. Recovery grief is something that happens over time, and there is no designation as to what that time might be. For some people, it might be 6 months. For some people, it might be a year. I know we talked last week about in olden times that people wore black for 6 months, and then they wore purple for another 6 months. Men wore black armbands to indicate that they were mourning. Women wore black, and if you watch Downton Abbey, you watch them all go through that change of clothing, which was the best part of Downton Abbey. I forgot her name now, but when Matthew died, who was her husband. And so that kind of outward expression of grief can often help in recovery. But recovery lasts for however long. But it's usually a brief kind of serious grieving, crying, recognizing the deep loss that surrounds us, and then a gradual moving back into life. Many younger people are able to do that because they don't see life quite the same way as those of us who are my age and older. That doesn't mean that the other kind of deep grieving doesn't occur. As I said, everyone is unique and different. So recovery is someone that you see is progressing as time goes by, getting better, returning to their normal activities, finding ways to fill in the pieces of their lives that are missing or different. And then resilient grief is someone who seems to not grieve at all, that they very quickly find their place, take care of what needs to be taken care of, and move forward. And some of us may look at that and say, oh, well, but how can that happen? Again, everyone's experience is unique. Every relationship is unique. Every death experience is unique. We don't know what went on in that relationship. We don't know the conversations that those two people might have had toward the end. It does not mean that there was no deep relationship. It does not mean that the person didn't love mother or father, brother or sister, spouse as much as anyone else. It just means they're different. They are unique. And I would ask again that you keep that in mind. So three ways that people respond to grief. Deep grief that goes on for a long time that we need to pay attention to. Because even though the depression that comes with grief is not like chronic depression or acute depression that people get from time to time, it can lead to that. And we want to be clear that we want to give them help so that that doesn't happen. Recovery, that which happens gradually over time, can be anywhere from 3 to 6 months to a year to 2 years to 3 years. And then resilient grief, those people who can accept it very quickly and move on with their lives. So what are some of the ways that we can move on with our lives? Well, one is something that we often see. The parents of Newtown, I don't mean to be staying on shootings, but a number of the parents from the Newtown experience have set up a foundation and are beginning to work with others towards the abolition of guns in schools. They're very much against gun violence, and they are still working very hard to do that. Other people get involved in organizations that are related to the illness the person might have. So there's a multiple myeloma organization. Actually, there are two of them, and I get emails from them every month. Some people get involved in the American Cancer Institute, if that's something that's been the cause of the death. With children, it might be a children's hospital like St. Jude's or the Shriners Children's Hospital or a local children's hospital. So it could be something related to the person who died. Could also be an interest that the person had. If the person was particularly an avid golfer or an avid skier or some other kind of activity, perhaps there might be a scholarship set up in their name for someone with gifts along that line. Some people do that. They get together and want to honor the memory through that. I have established a lectureship at St. Paul's Alexandria that will be the Mark Dyer Lectureship on Theology. And so once a year, they will bring someone in to give a lecture. So those are some of the things that people do. They get involved in activities that are help them to heal. The other thing that I have done is I commissioned someone to write a biography of my husband. Some of you might, I'm not a writer myself, but I'm delighted that that book has been completed and will be published sometime in the summer. You might want to do that yourself. You might want to journal about your life with the person who's gone. You might want to use that to remember wonderful things that have happened in your relationship. Did you travel somewhere? Did you, could be just a little short story about some kind of travel, or maybe remembering, if it was a parent, remembering some of the things that happened as you grew up. One of the things that, besides journaling, that also helps is to talk. You can talk into your phones these days. You can talk to your computers. You can talk to a tape recorder if you still have one of those around the house. And tell the story. I don't know how many of you listen to NPR and have heard about the StoryCorps and how those stories are being shared, and you can do that with your own personal story. Those stories are being shared, they're stored, in the Library of Congress, so that in times future, people will go back and be able to hear about the lives of ordinary people, not just those that get biographies written about them, but ordinary people. It's one of the things we often miss when we read histories, is that they're written, histories of war are written by the victors almost always. Okay. It's important that we look after ourselves as we grieve. It's important that we look after our health, that we be sure that we go to a doctor as regularly as we did before, to be sure that we tell our doctor the kinds of experiences we're going through. One of the things that is always helpful, and it's helpful for people who do that well, is to exercise. Just getting out in nature and walking helps us to realize that all of life is about birth, life, and death, and that it's all part of God's plan for our lives here, that all of us were born, all of us will live a life that is fulfilling, hopefully, having difficulties. Life is not a piece of cake, ever. And we will all die at some point in time. The younger we are, the less likely we are to think about that, unless something happens to someone close to us who is the same age. So, again, back to my first experience with my first husband, when I discovered that as a young widow, people responded to me very differently. Men friends who were husbands of my friends and otherwise either behaved somewhat inappropriately, or moved away from me. So I would, I remember my contractor coming after I built a house and kissing me as he came in the door. And I went, I don't like this. Not the thing to do. So I quickly showed him what I needed him to do and told him I had to go out. But I also remember sitting down next to a good friend, talking for a few minutes, and he made an excuse to get up and walk away. Now, what was that all about? Well, I think people recognize the vulnerability of someone who is young and grieving. So whether you're grieving for a husband or a mother or a father, they recognize your vulnerability, and some people take advantage of it. Some people are frightened by it. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to talk to you. They don't know how to say, I'm sorry. Or they're afraid that they might say something wrong. And I think that that's what was happening with the men. It wasn't that they didn't care about me. They didn't know what to say to me. They didn't know how to express themselves in ways that were helpful to either one of us, because what they saw when they looked at me was their own mortality. That could happen to them. Their families could be left. And that's something that we need to be patient with, back to that first word that we used today. Be patient, because everyone, again, is experiencing a grief differently. This time around, it was not that way. People wanted to talk about my husband. They wanted to share their grief and their experiences with him. So I didn't. I thought I'd have the same kinds of things happening, but that was not true. People hugged me. People kissed me, but not inappropriately. And people were willing to sit and talk with me. In fact, they're eager to. And in doing the biography, we went and spoke to over 100 people around the world who knew my husband. And they were all eager to talk for hours at a time and tell us all the memories that they had. So that was a healing for me as well. I keep getting ahead of myself.
Your thoughts remind me of, as a 7-year-old, I lost my dad. And your stories are reminding me of what I remembered as a child, that people were uncomfortable talking about it with me as a child and didn't spend a lot of time asking me how I felt. And now there are these great grief groups for families and children that didn't exist, but there aren't near enough of them in the locality. But I would go to people's houses that were my schoolmates to hear them talk. Sit at the dinner table, they would always have, you know, you'd go to a friend's house to sleep over and you'd sit at their dining room table and have dinner. And I would make up things, because notoriously they would say, oh, what does your father do for a living? So it's situations like that that I think happen to both adults, but a lot to children. So if any of us come across kids who have had loss or experiences, you know, I'd encourage us all to think about not addressing it. You know, I think you mm-hmm. think about men's reticence to perhaps bring up some of these things.
Can I say something?
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was an adoptive mom, a single woman, and she was older, and she adopted a little baby from Vietnam. And when the child was in kindergarten, she became very ill. And I had been like a friend with her. You know, we would go into, we shared the same daycare, and the child knew me, and we interacted with them. And she passed, and I was very concerned about the child, because I had no idea how the child was processing or, you know, what was happening with the child. So I went to the funeral home and all of that, and I noticed that the child was kind of standing by herself. And so I went up and addressed her just like I normally would address her, you know, and I said, now I'm blanking on the child's name, but I said, oh, Kira was her name. I said, Kira, how are you? And I actually got down at her level, and she said, Penny died. Penny isn't here anymore. Penny died. And I said, oh, okay. And I noticed that there were the principal from the elementary school and her kindergarten teachers had come, but they all were kind of, you know, back. But after I went over and I had a conversation with her, I noted that they all went over as a group and they got down where she was and they talked to her about her kindergarten, and her kindergarten class had made a little coloring book for her. And they gave her the coloring book and talked to her. But very normal, you know, like they were, and they were a little circle around her and, you know, let her talk and telling her that her friends in kindergarten had missed her and things like that. And so I guess I just throw this out there that for children, you know, I think it's very important for them if you have been a person, you know, in their life, if you can just be a normal, you know, treating them or relating to them the way you would normally do, and reach out to them, I think that it really helps them. And I saw the child smile, you know, and it was, you know, after the adults saw it was okay, they went over and they interacted with her the same way that they would have acted with her. And so I just want to throw that out there because I think children, you know, I didn't know what was going on in this child's mind, but I thought it was really important that she get a chance to, you know, say something about it.
Yes, that's lovely. That's absolutely beautiful. And that's important. We often try and shield children from death. We don't take them to the funeral home, or we don't take them to a funeral. Times have changed. There was a time when the body was laid out in the house, and the children saw what life and death was all about right in their very own homes. But we don't do that anymore. We take sick people off to the hospital. Fortunately, we're beginning to return to allowing people to die in their homes with the great benefit of hospice. But if someone goes off to the hospital or if it's a sudden death, then children don't see death, and we try to say, oh, you don't want to go. You don't want to see the body. You don't want to do this. And we need to let children make those decisions for themselves. So if they are reluctant and they say, no, I don't want to go, then we need to honor that. But if they say, yes, I do want to go, then we should let them and give them support. Now, that, of course, depends a great deal on the family members and how they're going to engage. If it's a young parent that has died and the other parent is beyond all consolation, that may not be a good thing for children to see. But we need to watch, observe, and step in when we can, and when it would be helpful.
She looked so alone, mm-hmm. And nobody was paying any attention to her.
And nobody should be alone. Nobody should be alone. We all need someone else. So even if you don't know the child but feel comfortable with children, you might go up and do get down on their level. My career is in early childhood development, so I've spent a lot of time with children and understand those kinds of things. When my own children were little, and when my husband died, they were 8 and 18 months, and there were no grief groups for children. I found all the books that I could, and we read a book called When a Parent Dies, which was stories that children had written or told to the author. It was Jill Kremen, I think her name was, the author, and she had written in their own, helped them write in their own words, their stories about losing a parent. And that was helpful somewhat to my daughter, my oldest daughter. My youngest didn't really remember much of anything, and says she doesn't remember her father. And that's sad. So we have tried to talk about him, tried to talk about the kinds of things that he liked to do. But as time moved on, our lives moved on. And we didn't dwell so much on the past. We moved away from where we lived. And so now it only comes up occasionally if we see or are visiting a place that has some reminiscence to our life together. But it doesn't necessarily bring back a lot of grief experiences that we have. Thank you very much for talking about that. Okay, so I wanted to say a little bit more about how to fill up that hole that's left. I think it's almost 10:30, right? So we need to leave some time for questions. All right. So let me say a little bit about the space that's left. When someone dies, their being, who they were, their personality, is gone. It's what we miss the most. And in that space, we need to, I think last week I said, we need to let it be for a while, and then we need to find ways to fill that space. So it might be moving things away, changing your environment. So if the person lived in the house with you, changing the room around where that was their room. Or if it's a spouse, I moved my bedroom around. I put a different bedspread on the bed. Took me a while. I didn't do it right away. But those were the kinds of things I did gradually over a year and a year and a half. It took me a while to get rid of his things. I'm still doing that. But it's now down to one drawer and a plastic container rather than all of the things that were in his dresser and his clothes. And some things I was able to get rid of quickly, like everyday clothes or things that I could easily take to the Goodwill or the Salvation Army. I just recently gave away his doctoral gown because I waited to find someone who would appreciate it. Because we were both PhDs, we wear the doctoral gowns to process, and so I gave it to a new friend who's come to the seminary and who didn't have one, and I asked if he would like to have Mark's doctoral gown, and he said yes. So I gave that to him so that he can wear it in our various processions. Some of the things that were very meaningful to my husband, I still have, but as soon as someone's occasionally, and I believe this is the work of the Holy Spirit, someone will say something, and I'll say, oh, I know just what to give you. And I would go and get the item that I felt my husband would want this person to have. So I've gradually been giving away things. I am fortunate in that a lot of his books and things will go to the library and be kept there for people to use in the future. But I've begun to fill up those spaces with other things. So if I took a picture off the wall, it was something that I liked that went back up. If I gave away a book, then a book that I liked went on the shelf in that place. So I was filling up the space. Now, one thing I know about that space is that it will always be there in some form. Someone once told me, and I'm sure other people have used this metaphor, if you've ever had surgery, you know that something is missing, okay? And the space is there, and there's a scar that results from the surgery. Well, that scar heals, that space fills up with something else, and you don't always, and you're certainly grateful that you don't have the pain or the discomfort or the illness that caused the surgery, but you know that scar's there. And if you touch that scar, it reminds you of what you went through. And so we all have scars. We all have wounds from a loss of those we have loved. Those wounds are not as visible as the scar from surgery. But you still touch them from time to time. And it's still painful when you do. But hopefully, as Christina Rossetti says, I'd rather that you remembered me and smiled. I would rather that you forget me and smiled than remember me and be sad. It's a poem that begins, "Remember me when you have gone away." You can Google it and it comes up. But that's the last lines. I'd rather you forget me and smile than remember me and be sad. So as you think about helping someone or filling up your own space, that has been created by the loss of a person. I would encourage you to find things that either support that person's interests, that are meaningful to you. It's not important that you fill it up with something that that person wanted, but you're not interested in. I watch the Hallmark Channel a lot, and the Hallmark movies are always about somebody who died and a new romance that comes into their lives. But there's some things you can learn from that, and one of them was a story about a young woman that was keeping a bicycle shop open that her husband had opened and then died shortly after he opened the bicycle shop. And the bicycle shop wasn't making any money, and her heart wasn't in it, and it made her sad every time she walked in the door. And her friends kept saying, "What do you want to do? What do you want to do?" And finally, she sold the bicycle shop and began to make cookies, which was something she had done all her life. And her cookies were evidently extremely delicious, and she became like another Mrs. Granny Smith's cookies or something like that. So, of course, a lovely, happy ending in the Hallmark stories. But that's an example of filling up our lives with something that was meaningful to the person who's gone but is not meaningful to us. And it only continues to keep the grief process going. Any questions about what I've said today or last week or thoughts that are running through your heads?
I have a question. A couple of years ago, my widow sister died suddenly, 73 years old. She had 6 children. 16-year age difference between the oldest and the youngest. They have been fighting ever since. Four oldest, one team, and the two youngest on the other team. Is that a reflection of them still going through this grief process, or is it something else?
That's a little bit hard to answer, not knowing the family and what, had they all been close before?
Yeah.
Often when there's that, I come from a family that has that kind of lifespan too. My sister was 18 years older than I am, and then I had brothers in between, and my youngest brother is 10 years older than I am. And what we have discovered and what may be going on there is that my parents were very different parents, and the family was a very different constellation when my three older siblings and my parents were together than when I came along. And so if I talk about my parents and the way they treated me or things they allowed me to do, my sister says, "I was never allowed to do that." And my brother said to me, "I think we had different parents." So it may be that the older ones remember their mother in a certain way, and so they're saying, "This is what she would want." And the younger ones are remembering her in a different way, and they're saying, "No, this is what she would want." I don't know what they're fighting over, whether it's possessions or disposition of real estate or whatever, but it could be that they have a different
money.
Money.
It's really not money, actually. It's what she said. Barbara was married and she was widowed. Her mother was always there. Then her mother died. So what happened is Barbara had to go back to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, working as a nurse. And she said to the oldest two, "Julie, Patrick, take care of this family, okay? So you have children in grief who are trying to do the best they can, trying to take care of the poor youngest, and it was very chaotic. I cannot tell you how emotionally chaotic it was. It was horrendous when her husband and her mother died in a short period of time. So when Barbara died, But I was with her at the moment of her death, because she died of an aneurysm. It exploded in her brain.
So it was sudden.
There was no way to save her. Her children were traumatized by this. I have been traumatized by it. What happened is it split 2 to 4. And these are now blaming the older ones of child abuse from when their dad and their grandmother died. The pastor really abused them. It was children trying to raise children.
Children.
So the whole thing has been an emotional turmoil. It's been horrible.
Are they in counseling? Is there counseling going on?
Some did and some won't.
Because it sounds like it's
complicated. Right.
Yeah.
We tried to encourage the bottom two to do it, and they wouldn't. Because even for us, it's been an emotional, horrendous thing.
Mm-hmm.
These people, she lived in New Jersey, we had our own room in that house. We were there constantly. She was the center of everything.
So it's the trauma. Right. It's the trauma of her sudden death. It's their relationships with their mother and how that was different. And it's obviously relationships with the children. They definitely need family counseling.
And then the two youngest bought mommy's house.
Another difficulty, yes.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, money, right, but it isn't money. It has nothing
mm-hmm.
to do with money.
No.
Can I share something?
Yes, please
so,
do.
My father died suddenly 2.5 years ago, and my stepmother has early onset Alzheimer's. So we were, in the moment my dad died, the four of us were kind of in charge of everything, and things were not planned in terms of his will and what was going to happen. So that was really complicated, and I wouldn't be surprised, I don't know the situation of the children, but if the parents haven't planned things really well, that's a real stressor for children. So everybody, please keep that in mind. I mean, we keep that in mind for our own children, and we have things planned already. That's really challenging to do all of that. So it sounds like they were already under so much stress, even when their mother was alive.
But that's exactly the situation.
That's a great reminder.
Yeah.
What you're saying, that will
it has to be, parents have to plan things. It's just not fair to your children to not have a plan.
But you don't think about it when you're never in my wildest dreams I ever thought that his sister would be dead. Because she was too vibrant.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you just never know, right?
Yeah.
Like, I could die tomorrow.
That's exactly.
I could be hit by a bus. Anybody could die.
Mm-hmm. Planning a party for the next day.
Yeah.
Everybody was coming to this huge annual 4th of July party. We didn't go to that because she now was dead.
And we never know when our death is going to come. So do prepare for it no matter what your age. Have a will. Have it written out. And if you can't afford a lawyer to do it, there are all kinds of things online that will help you, walk you through it. Even if you just have one of those kinds of wills, it will be better because your wishes will be there. Do an advance directive. One of the hardest things is, what do you do when someone is going to die? Do you keep them alive? For how long? For what purpose? And often there can be tension in families over situations like that, with one person wanting to let them go and another person not wanting to let them go. And again, relationships are complicated. So if you have said, this is what I want, and that's written down, and you give it to all the parties involved, that's really important. So do that.
It may be up to us in a community of faith for the whole stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To have
an
adult
ed program.
I would,
I think that's a good idea.
That.
So hard for
we're actually going
to
have a series in January, February called End of Life Issues, and we're having different Sundays having different things, and one of them is some of this advanced directives, wills.
That's right.
Yes.
There are all kinds of losses.
Yeah. And you You know, Eileen Jinx is having somebody here on dementia on Wednesday for anybody who can guess, and I'd encourage you to come.
But that, as you're talking about planning for your own kids, you also have to plan, you know, what if you're...
What if you're not mentally...
...long-term situation and not able to make decisions. Right. It's not always advanced directives or end of life. Sometimes it's long-term.
How do we deal with the loss? The loss of a life we thought was going to be one way, and it turns out to be another way. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to next week and what you will bring to the table, and thanks to you all for coming.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.